Welcome to the Product Podcast by Product School. Here's a preview of today's talk.
There is no substitute to real experience, and you should be ready to pivot and change. So actually sell your product, actually talk to your customers, because as a CEO or as a like product leader in a startup, you may have a lot of grand concepts, but it's only when you talk to a person and make a sale or listen to somebody who's bought your product, who tells you on your face why they are disgusted with your product, you will really understand what you need to do, right? So everything that you're going to learn from MBA or from like some entrepreneurship or product course, nothing is going to be useful unless you really know what's happening on the ground. You need to talk to your customers.
In this podcast, we teach our listeners valuable lessons about product management and transform them into thinking like a product manager. We teach product management, coding, data analytics, and blockchain in 14 campuses worldwide, including San Francisco, New York, and Seattle. You can find more information at productschool.com. Join our Slack community of 25,000 professionals to network and stay tuned for our upcoming events.
I'm Shoshish. How are you? I thought instead of doing like a boring lecture, I would talk a little bit about me and my experiences with product management and entrepreneurship. Let me start with a little bit about my journey into product management, right? Like, who am I? What are some of my attributes? As you can tell, I belong to the tech industry and the science community. I also talk about my qualities as an attribute. So I started as someone who was very interested always in liberal arts. So, right through my childhood and I would say adulthood, I was into writing, into poetry, reading, writing prose as well, into music composition, filmmaking even, right? And my first tryst with entrepreneurship actually came through filmmaking. Because I was making a film when I was not even 20. And this was like pre-digital era, so you couldn't shoot a film at 4K video with an iPhone, right? You actually needed to edit using very expensive editing processes which were not softwares at the time. So you actually needed real money to make films at the time, right? And I didn't have money to make the film, so I had to go to a lot of businesses and I had to find out ways how I could convince them to give me money. And the way I convinced them in giving money was, I'll have a scene in the film in which there is a student and that student is getting a PC delivered from a PC, shop. And you can see the name of the shop. Then there is a scene where somebody is reading a newspaper and you can see what is the name of the newspaper, right? So when I was a teenager, I sort of found out ways by which I could raise money for something that I wanted to do by also creating value and sort of market opportunities for other people, right? I also sort of approached product management and entrepreneurship from the perspective that I wanted to solve my problems and I wanted to build products and start ventures which would help me solve my problem and in the process also have a multiplier effect. That is not just solve problems for me but also solve problems for other people who are like me and who have similar problems. So one of the biggest problems I faced while I was making a film was to get everyone, like I wrote a script and I wrote the screenplay, but I was not terribly good at editing, I was not good at cinematography. I struggled with finding an actress. There were lots of problems, right? So anytime you do like a complicated venture which requires a lot of different disciplines, people from different places to come together, you sort of need a framework, you need sort of a network, and that is hard if you are an independent person. So I founded a thing which is called Open Cinema Foundation. So it was founded on similar principles as the Free Software Foundation, started by Richard Stallman. So the idea was, in Open Cinema Foundation, whether you are an actor or whether you are a writer or whoever you are, you could upload your content and I could use it as long as I give you credit for it. Everything is under Creative Commons, right? So this was a platform where artists and filmmakers and producers, everybody could come together. So it was not like an organized industry. It was like a multi-party sort of community, right? So as I was doing these things, I was really deeply into sort of creative arts. I soon figured out that my joy and fulfillment lied in actually shipping things, shipping tangible things, working with a lot of people, finding ways to make things happen. Around that time, I read a book which is called From Pepsi to Apple. It's a book which John Sculley, the ex-CEO of Pepsi and the ex-CEO of Apple, he wrote that book to justify why he fired Steve Jobs, right? And 550 or 70 pages of the book, you go through it and then you ask the same question, like, where are you going to justify firing that guy, right? But more than that, when I read that book, I really liked that idea of being a product visionary. Before I read that book, and I was a teenager then, I had no idea who's a product manager, or even the fact that product manager is a job. I didn't know I could do that job, because I didn't know that job existed, right? But as I read this book, I figured out there was a thing called as a product visionary, somebody who envisions a product, somebody who probably doesn't code, but who sees through the fact that a certain product gets launched. And that was sort of the germination in my mind when I started thinking that one day I want to be a product visionary, right? I studied computer science, I majored in computer science, and I entered the industry. I joined a company called as NetApp. Then I worked at EMC, and I have a friend from EMC who's sitting here. He was actually my teammate. So, great guy, you guys should know him too. When I entered the data storage industry, what I realized is data truly is like the fuel for this century, right? There was a time when oil was incredibly valuable. So anybody who worked with oil became rich. That's largely true today too, right? But today if you look at the market caps, ExxonMobil is like $375 billion, right? Apple is over $1 trillion, Amazon reached $1 trillion just a few days back, recently. So when I entered the data storage industry, what I realized was times have changed. Data is really fuel for this generation, right? And I never wanted to leave that industry. So through subsequent jobs, you know, I worked in NetApp, I worked at EMC, then I worked at Pure Storage, and now I worked at Google, right? Through all these jobs, I ensured I always worked with data products, right? Because one thing with data is it is exploding like crazy. Like even now at Google, how much data we have, it actually doubles every 6 months. And how much data we have at Google is massive. Like, I can't actually tell any numbers, but it's the kind of data that you guys don't even think exists in this universe, and we never see it, right? Nobody says. So one good thing that happened, because I never changed my domain, I always stayed with data, right, is that 13 years into my career and 13 years working in data storage, I sort of became, it's a very egoistic thing to say I'm an expert in data storage, but I would say I have domain expertise in data storage, right? So anything that you talk about data storage, I have some idea what you're talking about. I know the market, I know what is the TAM, what would be the Samsung if you want to launch a product. I know who are the big players. I know how to sell a data storage product. What are the markets? How do you target, right? So what I feel is if you change your domain a lot, that may be a good thing because you stay creative and you do like net new things a lot, right? But sometimes that also doesn't form that, you know, like that specialty or that intuition in you always. You stay in a domain for quite some time, right? And it was around this time that I started considering like serious business ideas. Like OpenSignal Foundation was a non-profit. It was not launched for money, right? It was there because I wanted to solve a problem for me and hopefully for others too. But it is around this time that I really started understanding how you generate a revenue model, how your product can make money. And I started a company which is called Itoji. It's a collaborative, market-based company which is in the food and tech sector, right? And it is around this time I did a management degree in software from Carnegie Mellon University. So I did a lot of research and experiments with different revenue models, right? I was actually at the time working as an engineer, but I started a product. So I wrote a product proposal, I went to our CTO, EMC CTO, and VP of engineering. I actually Google searched what is a product proposal. When I wrote it, I didn't know how you propose a product, right? Like, if you are an established PM, you write a PRD, but I was not an established PM then. So I said, okay, I have to convince people we should build this product. So what should I do? So I searched in Google, I found there is a thing called as a product proposal template. I downloaded it, I filled it up, and I had a few allies in the company who liked the idea, and then we went on to build the product. So I actually became a product visionary even at a time when I was not a product manager, right? I just wanted to do it. Even though as an engineer, I went ahead and I proposed a product and I got funded. Right? So that's how I entered the world of product management. And after that, I completely sort of moved out of engineering. And since then, I'm working as a product manager, right? So formally, if you look at PM responsibilities, what are the things that a PM does? Lots of different things. I wrote down some things that I worked on in the last quarter, right? I said, it is such an exhaustive list, I can't probably write, and probably different companies PMs do different things, but what is it that I have done in the last 2 months? P&L management, right? So how many of you know what is P&L management? Can you tell me what is it?
Like profit and loss management. Like
how do you manage profit and loss?
Yeah.
So if you can tell for everyone, what is P&L? Like what is profit and loss?
Sure, you essentially track your company's revenues, you track your company's expenses, you see what is the net profit, you see if you have a net profit, you see what's the net loss,
right.
And you essentially create a roadmap of how you're going to get to net profit eventually.
Right, so profit and loss P&L is basically a document which is like a balance sheet for your business, right? And if you have a product, as you said, if it is making money or whatever, it's making losses, P&L is basically your business sheet through which you track the business health, right? So not in every company a PM gets to manage P&L, but in some companies they do. So in those companies, usually you don't have a separate GM. So usually what happens is profit and loss is with a GM, who might be like an SVP at GM, right? But there are some companies where the PM manages the P&L. So in those companies, the PM is also the GM. So when you are managing P&L, you as a PM are fundamentally responsible for what happens to the business of that product, right? How much money it should make, how it should make that much money, how you should manage margins, right? So when you are that kind of a PM, your fundamental responsibility is to define the business execution of the product. So you are the business strategist of your product, you are the businessman for the product, right? And again, not every PM has to do it, I do it, I have to do it. That's how my company is. Product roadmap. So this might be clear to everyone. So product roadmap is you sort of come up with a roadmap. This quarter we're going to ship this, next quarter we're going to ship this, so on, right? PRD is basically product requirement document. So PRD is how you define what features go into the product. Then you do product launches. And again, there are some companies where marketing does the launches. PMMs do the launches at Google, usually the PMs also do the launches. Customer management, this is what you do every day. You talk to different customers, you understand what they want, you understand what are their pain points, what are their frustrations, right? You sort of keep a good balance of what they want and you try and keep them happy. So there is market research, competitive research, these are things, and then analyst relations. They all go hand in hand, right? So analyst relations, think of entities like Gartner, IDC, Forrester, ESG. So these are the analysts who are going to tell you, if you are trying to launch a product in a particular segment, how much money you can make, right? How much money other competition is making. So your competitive research can start from analyst relations. And it's very important for you to have good analyst relations, not just because you want information from them, but also things like Gartner Magic Quadrant, things like Forrester Wave. Would you be featured as a leader in the Forrester Wave or in the Gartner Magic Quadrant? These things depend on how good your relation is, how much information you are giving them, how you are convincing them that your product is a leader in this segment, right? Acquisition and investment research. So this is again, this may not be true for every PM and every company. But in the last couple of companies where I was a PM, I also had to do some research and I had to do some consulting to our investment arms and our acquisition arms, right? Because as a product manager, you also need to decide whether to build or to buy, right? Is building more expensive or is buying more expensive? Is building more strategic or is buying more strategic? Like if it will take me 2 years to build something, am I going to miss the market? or would I rather acquire something, is the price good enough, right? So even this is something, so this is again, classically, I don't think this is taught in like MBA schools. PMs don't think they will have to do acquisition until they become PMs, and then you realize, oh, this is also something. Because whether you build a product or buy, yes, a smart choice that you have to make, right? Working with engineering, UX, documentation, release management, so these things are pretty straightforward. You understand you have to do it. Working with sales, having regular relationships with sales, business development, partner management. Partnership is another thing. So I mentioned build versus buy. Likewise, whether to build or to buy or to partner. That's the other option you have, right? So you can say, I'm not going to build, I'm not going to buy, I'll just partner. For example, say I'm a primary storage company. I do not offer any backup, right? But I cannot get any customer to come and join and store their data with me unless they can also backup their data. So instead of me buying a backup company, which might cost me $1 billion to buy, or instead of me building a backup product, which might take me 4 years to build, it's a very complex product. It's a storage of last resort. Like, if your backup product uses your data, you have no data. All your backup is gone, right? So it might be smart to just partner with the company and say, hey, these are my APIs, these are my storage APIs, and let's just partner, right? And that's what all like pragmatic companies would do. Working with finance, legal, PR, when you are trying to launch something, when you are doing any communication, writing blogs, posts, communicating with your customers, you need to go through legal, PR, you need to ensure that there are no legal liabilities or exposure, right? And in terms of public relations, you are not going to cause a disaster. But working with finance goes hand in hand if you also manage the P&L. So what happens is, if you are managing the P&L, then every year you sign up for a certain revenue target. You say, this year we are going to make $700 million, or this year we are going to make $1 billion for this product, right? Now, finance would want you to sign up for as much as they can push you to. And this is where negotiation skills come handy. So as a PM, it is your duty. So finance may run, they might have their, you know, own models, and they can say, oh, last year we did 500 million, we are growing, like, we should grow 2x, we have to compete with company XYZ, look at where they are, look at where we are, shame on us, we should be 1 billion next year, right? So aspiration is good, but if you are not realistic, then the PM can get fired next year. If the PM signs up, oh, I'll do 1 billion, and then you end up doing 450 million, right? Then something is seriously wrong, because as a PM, you agree that we will do 1 million, and then you only did 450, right? So working with finance is can be a challenging thing unless you can, you know, back. So what should happen is, you should know your data better, and you should know your business better than finance people do. It is actually the case. Every PM knows their product and their business better than the finance people. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry for interrupting. My name is Dennis.
Hi, Dennis.
Just a short question regarding this PL structure, because I don't understand fully, but so that means like every product within Google has its own, is it like a separate identity as well, or how is it
set up? I can't
comment
about every product in Google. I can comment about my product in Google, and definitely a subset of products in Google. So Google has products which make money, right? Which have this revenue model. There are some products which are free products, right? Now, for products which make money, you need to track how is the product doing business-wise, right? So what you do is, there is a cost of running a product, which could be like the compute cost, storage cost, networking cost, plus, you know, the money that you pay to developers, to the site reliability engineer. So there is a cost of running a business, that's your cost, sales cost.
Yeah, right? But it means like the product is like a business by itself.
Yes.
It's also a legal identity by itself.
Yes. So if you have a P&L, it's basically a business license. So you have a P&L for a startup, you have a P&L for a company, likewise you have a P&L for a product.
Okay.
Right? And you have, usually what happens, in some other companies where I work, where individual products didn't have a P&L, their product portfolio had a P&L. So there would be 3-4 products clubbed together that would have a P&L. But maybe in some companies, if a product is very big, if you have a product which is making millions of dollars, then you need to pay for that. Getting back to my point with finance, right? The main thing I want to say is, finance people will always have their models. You need to have your models. And you need to be grounded in reality. Your estimations should be more precise than anyone else, because you are the product owner. Nobody has more business than knowing about your business than you, right? So that's something which becomes very important, especially if you go to a position where you have to manage P&L. Because then at the end of the day, your success or failure is not measured by how many products you launched, how many speeches you gave, right? Or how many customers you acquired. Your success or failure is measured by, okay, at the beginning of the year or at the half yearly point, this is how much I said the business will make. Did it make anywhere close? Or did I exceed? Or did I fall back, right? So you have been an excellent product manager, but you just made a wrong assumption about how much money you will make. And that might be enough to kick you out of the company. Right? So this is why, like, if you are a CEO too, and product managers in some companies are like new CEOs, right? You may be excellent and you might be doing a great job, but if the business is not doing great, then you may have to leave. Right? So it's very important therefore to have a very realistic estimation. So just like this, these are the things I said I did last quarter. So I thought, okay, if we look in terms of different functions or different constituencies, what are all the different constituencies that FBM has to work with, right? So you have customers, investors, press and media, marketing, sales, business development, legal, PR, finance, they are your ally, right? Same way you have analysts, you have other PMs, PM leadership, board members. So every quarter you may have to give presentations to board members and tell them what you are doing, right? So if you look at the whole PM land, there's a whole bunch of things happening. Like a PM could be a very stressed out person, or a PM could be at least a very, very busy person, right? And nobody might know how many other people you are working with. People might be thinking, what the hell this guy does? Like last time you wrote a PR, he was like 6 months back, right? I can bet this guy is doing nothing. Because, you know, your email may not be an open inbox. Usually it is not, right? So people may not know what you're doing, but you might be, you know, working with all these people. What this also means is you have to be a very good collaborator, right? And you have to be a really good cross-team player. You have to somehow juggle all the balls. So my understanding after working in product management for some time is, to be a good product manager, you need a combination of all these three things. You need little arts, little bit, right? Communication. If nothing else, communication. If you understand design, awesome, right? Even if you don't understand design, but if you understand fashion, if you understand trends, if you understand art, if you are connoisseur to something, it will help you tremendously. Because there is, you know, so many times you might have an awesome product but bad UI, and only because of the bad UI nobody used your product. Because, you know, nobody might know, like, your algorithms are better, your infrastructure is better. If the UI sucks, you may never use it, right? So I think to some degree, liberal arts, and definitely in communication, like if you send out a launch email or if you send out communication and if the language sucks, it's very bad, right? Business, of course, and then domain expertise, right? So I feel an ideal PM should have a confluence of these characteristics, right? So coming back to the attributes, right? Empathy, vision, passion, responsibility, people skills, like, anybody has any doubts that one of the attributes is not necessary? Yes.
I mean, what servant leadership?
So servant leadership, you know what is leadership.
Yeah.
So a PM has to be a leader because you need to take a call. So everybody can come up with suggestions. But the difference between a leader and somebody who is not a leader is the leader at the end of the day says, you know what, there are 10 ideas and maybe there is no best idea, but we'll go with this, right? So a leader is one who is not afraid of taking a decision because it may be non-ideal, but I'll still take it. Now, servant leader is somebody who doesn't think he's a leader. Servant leader is not somebody who has an ego. Servant leader is not somebody who is like dictatorial and authoritative. Servant leader is someone who's collaborative, right? It's almost like my leadership contribution is to facilitate your success. I'm a leader because I help you grow. Right, I'm a leader because I help you succeed. If that's your mentality, you are serving others. Right. So as a leader, you need to lead, but you also need to serve. What happens is in a PM job, nobody reports to you. That's the definition of a product manager. It's not a people management position. You manage the product, you don't have time to manage other people. Right. So you do not have authority because nobody reports to you. So you need to work with influence. And when you need to work with influence, you need to be a serving leader. Right? So I talked about authority. People who work in engineering, they may have authority because in the end engineering shifts, right? PMs need to always work with influence. And the way you work with influence is you need to gain credibility, you need to gain trust, you need to gain respect, right? you should be, like how other team members should view you, how your engineers, how your UX people should view you is as a team member. Like not as somebody who comes and distracts them from work, right? But as somebody who works alongside them and who makes it, you know, who makes it a little easier to do things. So the way you gain influence is by working for others, by making tangible, positive contribution for other people, by helping people. Many people think, oh, I'm going to be seen as somebody with an influence if I don't eat with others. You know, if I have like this exclusivity about me and talk big stuff, right? So that's not influence, that's just isolation. There's a difference between isolation and influence. Influence is, I'll be down in the trenches working with all of you, right? And you will look at me as a team member. So anytime you have a problem, you come to me. Not because I have authority, but because you think I can help you, right? So responsibility is something that a PM has to take. So a PM who says if a failure happens or if something goes south, and PM says, oh, this was not me, this was this engineer, right? Or this was not me, finance came up with wrong estimates, right? So that's not a good PM. A good PM is someone who takes responsibility, and a good PM is someone who works with influence.
If you have enjoyed the episode so far, check out our upcoming live events at productschool.com/events. Use the promo code PRODUCTPODCAST in all caps to get a free ticket to the next event in your city.
I also learned doing products and startups and making mistakes. So every single bullet point you see here is basically my learning from my mistakes, right? So it's very important if you are building a product in a startup to not have grand hypotheses. Like, I literally spent 1 year, 1.5 years building something because I thought, you know, I knew what to build, right? There is a quotation which says, there is no business plan which survives its first contact with the customer, right? Likewise, there is no product which survives its first use by a customer. So there is no point burning money, there is no point wasting time. Don't have a grand hypothesis. Build small improvements. Build small things, ship them, get people to use them, get feedback, right? You are not your user. You should not make something just the way you would like it. You should know who's your user. Most of the times product fail because product managers do not know who their users are, right? So you see, lots of time, many films, they flop, and they're good films. They do not flop because the director made a bad film. The film flops because it didn't deliver to its target segment. Say you are making a movie about young people, right? If you do not know what their aspirations are, what do they want in a movie, then it won't run, right? So you need to know very well who's your target audience. You need to know very well who's your user, right? So I may have my biases, I may like certain colors, I may like certain fonts, I may like certain designs, right? I may like certain revenue models, I may like not paying in capex, I may like paying subscriptions, right? But I may not be the one who will pay for the product. So it's very important to know who your product is, right? Focusing on important problems. Many times I have seen, so I advise startups as well, and I work very closely with startups. Many times I see founders or would-be founders, they come and they say, hey, these are our strengths, right? These are our unique differentiation, this is our IP, this is why we are different. Nobody has this tech, only we have this thing, right? Your customers are not going to know you. Your customers are not going to know your stack. What your customers should know is, what is the problem you solve for them? So it is important to think about what are the main problems for your customers. It is very important to solve those problems. You should focus on the problem. So when I started my first startup, somebody told me that this problem you are solving, Shubhashish, you should solve this in Django framework, right? And he was like an expert. He is an expert engineer. So I said, okay, I need to solve it in Django framework. And somebody said there was another framework that was not good. So then I hunted, like, where would I get Django developers? It was a real hunt that I did. And then I finally found people who do Django. They asked me more money than, like, if I went with a different framework. I said, no, I need to do this, right? Because Django is like a better easy-included framework. So if you use Django, you can scale very well. And scaling would never be an issue. Distributed locking would never be an issue. Lots of things would not be an issue. But what if you never get that kind of traction? And you are like hunting. specific skill set developers, you are spending more money, you are spending more time, right? So focus should be on nothing else. Focus should be on what is the problem you are solving. You solve it the worst way possible, but you solve the problem, you will have a paying customer. And then you can solve it more elegantly. You can iterate. One day you can solve it like how Steve Jobs solved it, right? But it's important to get a start. You cannot always get ahead of yourself and make the most grand design. Because what if you never get any use? What if the problem that you are solving is wrong? You should be solving another problem, right? Business model. There are many, many startup product people who only obsess about the product. Like, they start and end with the product as this, the product as that, and all that kind of stuff, right? You ask them, what's your revenue model? They would not even talk about revenue model. Because most times what they say is, you know, we are not really thinking about revenue. If we start getting revenue, our post money valuation is going to go down because that will be a number, right? So they are already thinking in terms of exits. They are already thinking like tertiary matrix. That's not how startups work. That's how startups fail, right? So people will say, oh, I'm just building a community, I'm just building a marketplace. 5 years later, you'll find out how to do it. Right? Like, didn't Google do that? Didn't Facebook do that? Didn't Instagram do that? Lots of people did it. But guess what? You go to a VC or you go to an angel and you say, my revenue model is ads. Let's see how many of you get funded. Right? So what's really important, so when I started my startup, from day one, I made money. Right? Like, every single time we shipped a product or delivered our service, we made money. So, you know, we are one of those rare companies who afforded not to raise any money. There is a company called Bose. Bose makes, you know, speakers and headphones and stuff like that, right? They were always privately held. They never went to an IPO, right? And after the owner, Bose, I call it the first name, after he died, he like donated the company back to MIT. Basically, all the proceeds from the company, all the profit goes to MIT, right? Amazon, such a big company, Amazon ever, like in his history, only raised $1 million, just one. Right, and if you look at Crunchbase, if you look at lots of websites, there are so many companies who have raised ungodly amounts of money, like tens of billions of dollars, billions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars. They're nowhere close to Amazon, and they may never be. Right. So, how much money you raise and how your term sheet looks should not be your criteria. Right. Focus on the business model. If you have a solid business model. I can even tell you, you may not even know need a VC. And many times if you get a VC, they will push you in a different direction than where you want to go. Right? There is no substitute to real experience, and you should be ready to pivot and change. So actually sell your product, actually talk to your customers, because as a CEO or as a, you know, like product leader in a startup, you may have a lot of grand concepts. But it's only when you talk to a person and make a sale or listen to somebody who's bought your product, who tells you on your face why they are disgusted with your product, you will really understand what you need to do. Right? So everything that you're going to learn from MBA or from like some entrepreneurship or product course, nothing is going to be useful unless you really know what's happening on the ground. You need to talk to your customers. So I talked about products at a startup. What about managing $1 billion product, right? Because managing $1 billion product is very different than managing a product at a startup. So when you have $1 billion product, there is an 80-20 rule. Sometimes, depending on the company, it might be even a 90-10 rule. You can think of this way: 80% of your business comes from 20% of your customers, or 90% of your business comes from 10% of your customers, right? So, although it seems uncharitable that I'm not thinking about all my customers, but you know, if you have millions of customers, you may not think about all your customers because you can't build for all of them, right? But if you can build for that 10% customer, if you have pulse of that 10% customer who contribute 90% of your revenue, then you will succeed as a company. So that this is one major difference between a startup and managing $1 billion product. Because at that kind of scale, you can't be solving everyone's problem. There will be a million problems to solve, right? So you should focus on a really narrow segment of the problem. Expectation management of all stakeholders. This is also related to what you were saying, right? So oftentimes, like you would see, like if you talk to VP of products, they will tell you something. If you talk to like VP of engineering, they have a different expectation. You know, your most talented engineers, they might have a different view, right? Maybe the engineer, he wants to do a very exciting sort of taking the project, right? A very rewarding technical project. Maybe VP of engineering wants to keep their engineers engaged and they want to just do something so that everyone will be engaged, right? And your product leader might be trying to make money, right? So keeping everybody on the same page is an art. And I'll talk about the framework, how to do it. But you have to be mindful that as a PM, you balance everything. So you need to keep everybody on the same page. If you do not do it, your experience will be under there. So maybe somebody will be happy with you, somebody else won't be. But more importantly, people might have different expectations of a situation, and that can cause a problem, right? So biggest revenue blocker, as a big company, as a big product, as a billion-dollar product, one of the advantages that you have is you don't have to hunt for what should I do next, because your sales team will tell you that, you know, this much revenue is blocked on this feature, that much revenue is blocked on that feature, right? So as a PM, you can succeed in a very high-scale product if you just look at, okay, what are the biggest revenues which are blocked in my product, right? So you don't have to do very creative things. You just go, you know, from the top and you say, I'm just blocking the biggest, unblocking the biggest revenue blocks. Now this is something you couldn't do in a startup. Right. So in a startup, you have to listen to your customers. But in a scaled-up environment where you are managing a billion-dollar product, you can succeed by not even talking to customers at all, because your sales is telling you where you can put a lot of money. Right? Prioritization and stack ranking. So oftentimes, what happens is engineering maintains a different stack rank, and product maintains a different stack rank. Product says, I can't have your items on my stack rank because your items are not customer-facing items, right? So you maintain that in your stack rank, not in mine. That's a very flawed concept. The reason is nobody should do anything which in some way, shape or form doesn't impact customers, right? So maybe something is a UI feature visible to a customer. Something may be a resiliency feature not visible to the customer. But if you do not do it, then customers are going to have an outage, right? So as a PM, you need to find a way to rework different product, different catalogs, fuse them into one, and express everything as what value it delivers to the customer, right? So instead of saying refactor code to do X, Y, Z, you should say, you can say, one way could be refactor code so that customers get this benefit, or refactor code so that customers get a more solid product, right? But it's important to have one stack ranking. If you do not have one stack ranking, then the question that you were asking, like, you know, I go talk to one person, I talk to another person, I talk to another person, how do I keep everything concerted, right? Because different people might have different idea of importance. So your engineering leader might say, oh, okay, you as a PM want to build this thing, but I want to build this thing, because if I don't build this thing, nobody's going to use your feature. Say, I'm from cloud, right? I'm a product manager at Google Cloud. If cloud goes down, then it doesn't matter how many features I'm building. Nobody's going to come. Like, the only way we can screw up a cloud business is if there is an outage for multiple days, right? So the engineering leader might say, I don't care about your, you know, like, backlog. Because for me, what matters is resiliency. What matters for me is reliability. Where is that in your backlog? Show me an item where your number one item is reliability, right? So what you need to do as a product leader is, you need to ensure that everything is stack ranked. There is one stack rank, the whole organization has one stack rank. If you can manage it, everybody will be on the same page. If you manage it, you don't have to manage people, right? What happens usually is engineering runs their own thing, product runs their own thing, and then there is like every quarter in the beginning of the quarter, you guys talk and you guys plan. That's a sure shot, chick show model, you think, if you have that model, right? The right way to do is as a PM, you join an organization, be there for a quarter, be there for 2 quarters, be there for 3 quarters, but pretty soon you build consensus and you say, you know what, all of us need to move to one prioritized list. And if you can do it as a PM, half of your job is done. Like, 10 people can tell you 10 different things, but everything will be in concert. Things will not be distorted, right? Key metrics. If you are tracking 100 metrics, I'll come to you in a second. If you are looking at 100 metrics, if you have like a dashboard and you look at like 50 different things, it's pointless. Because 50 different things may not be actionable, right? The only metrics you should look at and the only metrics you should track are the metrics which you know how to change. Like, if I change this thing in the product, like if I drop price by this percentage, this number will grow. Or if I gave this much percentage more performance, then I'll have this many customers in a region, right? So it's pointless to track 100 metrics. Like as a PM, always it has been around the tracking 3 metrics. And I see people have lots of dashboards and like lots of visualization and lots of stuff. It's good as an intellectual satisfaction, but it's not good if you want to, like you look at a car, right? Or you look at an aeroplane, right? How many dials do you have? Usually you have dials which inform you, but also dials which will change if you change something. Like if you put thrust, you will see that a dial will change, right? If you accelerate, if you brake, there are certain things which change. If you change here, something changes. What is the point of putting 10 things in your dashboard in a car if you don't know how to change them, right? Like if your engine is too hot, you should know how to cool it, right? You are seeing there is temperature in the car. You turn it down, turn the dial down, you know how to control it, right? So it is futile to do very fancy analytics and do a lot of metrics. It's good to show to your bosses that you are doing something, but it will not help you succeed as a product manager. What will really help you succeed as a product manager is if you have very actionable metrics, right? And then there is a couple of thoughts, differentiate value, create different value. The main thing I wanted to say here is like, just because Amazon is doing this, so we should do this. Oh, Google is doing AI, ML, so everybody should do AI, right? Like these days, you go to any VC firms, or if you go to any investment forums, everybody is talking AI, ML. Some days back it was IoT, some days back it was something else. It's the hype cycle, if you really got the hype cycle, right? You are forever chasing hype. That's not how you make money. That's how you generate hype, right? If you want to make money, you should focus on the users. So Google has this document which is called 10 things document. 10 things we know to be true. And the first thing in that 10 thing is focus on the user and all the things will follow. So what it is basically trying to say is respect the user, really focus on what the user needs. And if you deliver what the user needs, you will succeed, right? So fundamentals of influence, right? So I have in my life learned a lot from people who might not like. So when I became a manager, before I became a manager, I wrote a Google Doc. And I wrote, what are all the things I have learned from the managers whom I did not respect or whom I did not like? Because that was a very good learning for me so that I don't do the same mistakes, so that I won't turn out like them, right? Truth is very important. So, you know, you mentioned that you might be talking to lots of different people, right? It's very important that you are always truthful. Like there is only one truth. The thing about truth is it's not subjective. Like many people say, oh, there is no such thing as truth. Fake news, post-truth, right? Your truth, my truth. Truth is not a relativistic thing. Truth doesn't, or at least it shouldn't, if it is really the truth, depend on a frame of reference. There should be one absolute truth. As a PM, you should never lie, right? As a PM, you should never try to manipulate. As a PM, you should never say something that's not true just to get something done. If you do it, you saw how many constituencies I deal with. If I say one thing to somebody that was not true, I'll not remember it. I'll say something else to somebody else. Those two people will talk, right? The way PMs lose influence, I have seen some great PMs in my life, really talented PMs who lost influence in a company and they had to leave because nobody would build things for them because they lost credibility. And the reason they lost credibility is because they were very smart. They were always manipulating. But karma catches up, in some time people found out that they are not going to go. It's very important that you should never take shortcuts. It's very easy to propel people into action by doomsday prophecies. You know, like you say, if you don't do this, this customer is going to go to AWS. But if you don't do this, you are going to lose this much business, right? So it's very important that you never... inspiration is much better than fear. Like, if I have to get work done, by inspiration, it may take me more time. It's much better I do that rather than I fear and submit people into action. So these are some long-term things which work, right? So right intention is very important. Likewise, right view is very important. So what happens is why right view is very important is before you decide what is your intention or before you decide what is your communication or what is your action, you need to first know whether you have the right view. If you only have a partial view, or if you have a flawed view, then your action will be wrong, maybe your intention will be wrong, right? Very simple example in life, like these days a lot of mob justice happens on Facebook, somebody writes a Facebook post, oh, this guy is so bad, he did this, blah, blah, blah. And then everybody is like mob mentality, saying bad things. And then somebody says, you know what, this is not the truth. Actually, this didn't happen, something else happened. And then people are like, oh, so see, their intention was right, but their view was wrong, right? So as a PM, you deal with so many different constituencies. It's not always possible to have the right outcome if you do not have the right view. So before you decide to act, ask yourself, do I have the right view? Am I seeing everything, right? And most times, what happens is you don't have an impartial view because you have the eye, right? It's because you are not isolated. So what happens is, maybe you are making a mistake. Maybe your decision is wrong. But because you need to defend yourself, it's a primal instinct, right? So you make a wrong decision. So your intention, view, these things are very connected. How you know your view is right? You know your view is right if in a given situation, in a given argument, you can see you there. And you know, at that point, the I and the you are separate. So if you can see this is a given situation, and in this given situation, I becomes a third person, and this is what the third person wants, that is when you know you have right view. So you can either learn this from me today, or you will learn this when you have a major disaster in product management where something bad happened. And that something bad happened because you were defensive. You couldn't isolate yourself from the decision-making process. So the only way you can ensure that you have the right view is if you separate your ego, if you separate yourself, put yourself as a third person, then you say, okay, you know, VP of engineering is asking this. Sales head of Europe is asking this. And the product manager, not me, the product manager is saying this. So now let's see what is right. You know, so that's sort of a test for you to know whether your view is right. Intention should be right. The intention should not be you want to win. The intention should not be people should praise you. That should not be the intention. For me as a product manager, my intention is my product should grow. And my product should make money. That's really what my intention is, right? And my customer should be happy because that's when they will spend more time and more money on my product, right? Right attention is very important. So you again mentioned that, you know, you are talking to so many different people. So I've seen a lot of zombie PMs. So like my work day is 11 back-to-back meetings. Or like today I had probably 14 back-to-back meetings, right? So I see a lot of people like ghost walk through their meetings. Like they would nod their head and they would be in lava lamp, right? But what happens is somewhere you fail as a value creator. Because, you know, creativity, many people think a PM should be creative. Now, creation has already happened. The universe exists. You cannot create, you can only imitate. You can combine, right? A good PM is a combinatrix. A good PM is somebody who takes this from one person, that from another person. If you zombie walk through a conversation, if you are not paying right attention, great ideas won't enter you. You normally have your deluded ideas, you know? So, a good PM has to be an open system. Like, I can get an idea from a child, I can get an idea from a fresher, like who's interning, right? But because they think everything so freshly, they may come up with such an original insight that I had never thought, right? So, as a PM, it is incredibly important to be always in the moment, right? And like what I take from my spirituality, I give it to my body. So, what I mean by that is, I have learned to always be present in a certain good moment. So when I'm here, I'm here. And when I'm here, I'm exactly here this second. So when I'm sitting with a person and I know I have 10 more meetings that day, but I'm not thinking about anything else. I'm thinking about that moment. And that helps you generate value. That helps you get things from other people which you can then combine and make a beautiful product, right? And, you know, a few things about decision-making. Many times, like Steve Jobs had great instinct. Probably Elon Musk has great intuition, right? Maybe you have great instinct and great intuition too. Nothing wrong. Only if you have it, it will really help you. But you need to back them up with real facts. Like, if you have great intuition, if you have great instinct, work 10 times harder to back them up with data. Because what will happen is, if you are in a situation of conflict, and all you have to back yourself is your instinct, you are not going to win that argument. If you are a first level PM, say you join a PM job, you are a first level PM, and you are in a conflict with a senior vice president, or you are in a conflict with the CEO, you are not going to win by trying to prove your instinct is better than him or her, right? The only way you will win is, forget about your instinct if you can just back up with data, right? You know, you asked me what's my matrix for prioritization. That's my metrics for everything. So whenever I go into any discussion, I go into any debate, I show how much money you can make, I show these are the customer segments. It's very fact driven, right? So it's great to have great instinct, but it's greater to have or to actually do a little more extra work. Don't be complacent just because you are great or because you are smart, right? Because you are talented. Work a little more and actually gather the data so that you can rank your algorithms, right? Now, lots of people as PMs can't get work done, not because of any other reason, but because they suck as being Boolean beings. You know, like they are so arrogant, nobody wants to listen to them, nobody wants to work with them. And they think, oh, we became a PM, you know, we are like driving $1 billion products and we are coming up with these ideas and this and that, right? Guess what? You are not going to write the code. You are not going to be the guy who writes the blog post. You are not going to be the guy who's actually out in the field taking interviews and making videos, right? You are not the guy who's going to sell your product. If you genuinely fall in love with everybody that you work with, right? If that happens, if work for you is a love affair, and everybody that you work with, every moment of your work, if this is like an unconditional love, as a PM, you succeed. There is no bigger mantra to success as a PM than to be genuinely in love with the people that you work, right? And if you land up in a company where you can't love the people, leave the company, right? But don't be a PM who is not in love with his people or other people, right? Only when you unconditionally care about everybody, and at any given moment what you are trying to do is to help them, to make their experience better, to add value to them, you would see everything would come back to you in a compounded form, right? So why this is incredibly important for PMs is, as an engineering manager, you are still sort of working with like within one vertical, right? As a PM, you are working with so many different functions. To ship a product, there are so many things it takes. Like an engineer would think, oh, all it takes is my coding. Without my coding, this product wouldn't have shipped. But if you actually look at the mechanics of a launch, there are probably 30 different functions at different points in time which comes into launching of a successful product, right? And if these people are not motivated, if they don't want to work for you, that product won't ship. It won't ship in time, it won't ship in quality. So it's very important for others to fall in love with you, and the only way it can happen is if you fall in love with them, right? So at any point, never ask yourself, like, what is there in it for you? Like, would I get promoted if I ship this, right? Would my career progression happen? That's the wrong way. If you divorce these thoughts, and if you go into something, I really want to do this because I love it, and I love everybody that works, right? So it may sound a little theoretical, and it may sound a little idealistic, but with practice, you can actually do it. So I feel a PM should be like a PM in some countries, like a prime minister. Like a PM should be somebody who's actually trying to do genuinely good things for the people they work with and for their customers. If you fall in love with your people, if you fall in love with your users, your product will get a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening to the Product Podcast. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes. If you want to know more about our courses and next course, visit productschool.com. Stay tuned for the next episode to learn more about the secrets in product management.